It's The Wonky Show. Graduates are grinding through with thousands of job applications. Is AI to blame? A new report says student protection plans aren't worth the paper they're not printed on. So what happens when a provider pulls the plug? And UCAS data's out. We'll look at the state of play. It's all coming up.
We should be endeavouring to support students in many ways, including the availability of jobs. There's probably more that can be done to sort of create much more flexible opportunities for students to work.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to explore the week's developments, as usual, three excellent guests. In Lit Hook, Hilary Gebbiabba-Bayo is Head of Public Affairs at GISC. Hilary, your highlight of the week, please.
I've actually just gotten back from Morocco on a nice break, and my highlight is the slow return of my voice after some really bad karaoke.
Most industrial Swansea. Hugh Jones is as an independent consultant and higher education postcard maestro. Hugh, your highlight of the week, please.
Thank you very much, Jim. My highlight of the week would be I went to a fabulous board meeting at Birmingham City University over the last 2 days. Cannot beat it.
Fantastic. And in Stoke-on-Trent this week, Michael Salmon is news editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I think I'm legally required to say that it was watching my son in his school play. He was good, though.
School plays sell out. Now, so yes, we start this week with graduate jobs. Every time I open the paper, because, you know, I still buy newspapers, the robots are coming. Or are they, Michael?
Yeah, it has been a bit of a relentless month or so of scare stories in across all the broadsheets, really. You know, we could have done this item any time since the middle of June, really. But yeah, there was a fresh round of stuff in The Guardian at the weekend about, you know, graduates' job hunting woes amid the AI fallout. You know, the sort of premise here is that it's becoming really, really, really hard for graduates to get jobs because AI has sort of taken all the entry-level positions. The job market has totally changed. And also, as a kind of corollary, the application process has become impossible because everyone's sort of banging out applications with AI. Employers are sifting them with AI. No one's actually either writing or reading them, and it's all very depressing. You know, it's always interesting when one of these stories gets a sort of critical mass in the papers where, you know, a small data point is seized on. You know, some PR firm sends out quite a small scale survey. I think in this case, it seems to have started with some data on job vacancies, which isn't really the same as anything about applications or acceptances or anything like that. It's just a sort of, you know, fairly partial slice of one company's data. But yeah, it's engendered all kinds of terrible coverage. I thought I might just read out a few headlines we've had in the last month. So we've got, it's a bad time to be a graduate, 1,000 applications to get a job, the graduate grind, UK graduates facing worst job market since 2018, Britain's graduates left on the scrap heap, scammers target struggling graduates, entry-level jobs in free fall, I'm a Cambridge student, Rachel Reeves has made job hunting impossible. That last one, of course, from The Telegraph. And, you know, I think that one of the few ones that didn't sort of pin the blame on AI. But, you know, it is an interesting question to what extent this is really about AI and a change in the job market, and to what extent it's more just the fruit of a sluggish economy added to sort of newspapers looking for something to worry their readers about.
Well, this is fascinating. Hugh, what's your theory? Is it, you know, are the robots coming, or is this a, you know, a kind of sluggish post-pandemic economy? You know, what do you reckon?
So I think it's bound to be a bit of both, isn't it? Come on, let's go straight for the middle of the road if we can do. There's clearly an element which is about changing nature of jobs, the changing nature of work, the increasing adoption of AI tools within roles. And some of this is people are using AI to make jobs easier for themselves. And we see a lot of that around the place with people using scheduling tools or whatever. That's fine. Good stuff. Not good stuff at all. I don't believe it, but never mind that. But there's also a sense in which companies are moving towards business models, towards operating models, which actually try to remove the human element. And this is nothing new. I mean, this is something which has been going on for hundreds of years. If you think about ways in which new technology turns up, replaces previous person-intensive roles, and we move on. Now, whether this is doom and gloom forever, or whether this is a temporary bit while we work out what are the things that we still do better than AI, and that's where we add value. I don't know. I mean, you got the replacement of, and that's why I'm just reading a book, which is in part going about the changing nature of Britain's landscape and how industry changed things in part, and colonial endeavors changed things. And what's clear is that the introduction of machinery into the textiles industry, for example, yes, it displaced a lot of people for manual jobs, then it creates a lot of jobs. And so are we seeing that transition here and we're just in the middle of it? Is the economy sluggish? Of course it is. Of course it is. And I'm sure that if you look at the data, there's a huge difference between jobs and the situation in the southeast of England versus jobs and the situation in the rest of the country. So there's a slice of this, which is probably about differences in the economic performance of different parts of the country as well.
Well, I mean, this is fascinating. I mean, Hillary, I guess part of it is, my sort of sense of this is that those previous shifts that Hugh talks about, quite often in those scenarios, the robots came for other jobs in the labour market. And there's a kind of sense, I think, that this time the robots are coming for graduate jobs. Is that, do you know what I mean? Is that, am I just kind of, is this nonsense?
I wouldn't say it's all nonsense. I think that technology has developed in such a way where it's having much broader impact on the wider job market. And particularly for graduates, I think they're always going to feel any strain in the job market acutely transitioning from one stage of their life where, you know, it's felt really guaranteed moving from educational institution to educational institution. And now they're in the big wide world thinking a little bit about what they're going to do with their lives moving forward. But I do think that, you know, in many ways, this has been inevitable and actually reflects the fact that digital and technology is requiring more skills and capabilities out of those entering the job market. And so, you know, I think what we do need to focus on a little bit more isn't that it's getting particularly harder, because I think for the past few years, the graduate market has been hard in general, but are we doing enough to support graduates to go into an ever-changing market that requires them to be a bit better in their digital skills, digital capabilities, and to engage with these new technologies in ways that allows them to be included in this change rather than excluded by staying in more traditional models of learning and engaging with what work will look like in the future.
Michael, can we dig into this volume of applications thing, right? So obviously lots of the coverage is saying, you know, 1,000 applications for one job and we used to only get 10. But I was at a student's union the other day and they'd got, you know, a sort of relatively entry level kind of professional rollout. And they'd had like 150 applications and they would normally get 5. And what they were saying was that 140 of them were basically the same kind of AI slot that you might see in the kind of raw feed on X. Do you know what I mean? So is it that it's become devilishly easy to just bang in an application, or is this, you know, a real crisis? Do we know?
I mean, I think it's not a real crisis. I think if you look at the actual employment data, we can certainly say it's, you know, it's a difficult, tough time to be a graduate, but there's no proper, you know, statistical reason to think that suddenly, you know, it's getting impossible to get a job. You know, on the sort of application front, I think that point is right, that there's just, you know, a much higher volume of applications going in. Probably lots of them are fairly easy to reject for certain companies that have got their processes set up. But I can imagine for, you know, for small employers, it must be, you know, really overwhelming at the moment just to suddenly get, you know, hundreds, if not more, of applications that are sort of written in quite peculiar, hard to read sort of ways. You know, they're doing that sort of AI trying to please you kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I think it's not just about the volume. I think, and we see this come across in the papers quite a lot, that there's just sort of something quite soul crushing about what the application process is like for lots of jobs at the moment. It's not just about application letters. It's also about, you know, having to go through multiple rounds of interviews that are often run by AI agents rather than humans for, you know, for certain kinds of graduate employers. I mean, you do hear lots of stories about, you know, students and recent students just saying, God, the process process is just not at all what I was expected. It's just, you know, it's dull, it's sort of lacking human contact, and it's really dispiriting.
Okay, well, look, Hugh, I think this then raises another question, which is, I think there's a way to look at this, which is kind of about careers and employability. And, you know, is that bit where you take all the stuff you've got from your degree and someone helps you then sell that to an employer? Maybe that bit needs to change because the process of getting a job has changed. But actually, I've been talking to quite a few student leaders already this summer who are saying they are terrified that they now have skills that are not valuable. So, you know, I overtell this story, but at the end of my first year as an undergraduate a very long time ago, I got a student staff job in the university, which involved putting a lot of reel-to-reel tape recorders in the skip. And that was amusing, largely because I'd used them all year to edit a podcast. So I was at the end of the year thinking, what a waste of time that was. All those skills I've learned kind of editing audio using a knife are no longer valuable. Have we got a skills valuable problem here? Or is it just about kind of process and how people express themselves to employers?
I think I don't think there's a crisis in that one here. And I don't think knowledge ever goes out of date in that way. If you read Ron Barnett, and we should all read Ron Barnett on a regular basis, a lot of what he says about higher education and the impact of a degree on students, it's about the transformational nature of study on the student. So it's not so much about, yes, I've learned these skills, because of course we all do learn skills during our degree, but it's about the capacity to keep on learning and keep on developing. That, to my mind, is what graduateness is really about. So my first degree, so did philosophy. Do I, on a regular basis, have to engage with the debates about epistemology? No, I don't. Do I regularly have to use the skills I've got around how to spot a good and a bad argument? Yes, I do. And so if you look at the graduate skills, it's not often the content. It's the abilities that go with it, whether it's high-level analytical skills, whether it's communication skills, and all of those things. I bet your knowledge of slicing tape and binding together sellotape, I bet that's useful to you, not because you still do that, but because you understand something fundamental about how sound is used to communicate. So we're doing this now, and you know full well what's going to be a good moment to talk, what's going to be a bad moment to talk, where the silences matter, where the silences don't matter. And that came from mucking about with a knife and tape, but you don't use a knife and tape anymore. I think that's the point about graduate skills. It's really about how do you learn to learn new stuff, and how do you understand the deeper prospects, deeper propositions about value in whatever it is you're trying to do.
Hilary, let me ask you, okay, I mean, look, all right, okay, fair enough. I mean, I think I know where she's coming from, but it strikes me that in that case, you know, one of the things that students probably need is, and when I say students, I mean all students, right, probably need, you know, the kind of tools and digital literacy to keep up. So if graduateness, you know, includes things like critical thinking and so on, it just feels like graduateness now also ought to universally include some stuff around digital literacy. But, you know, there are plenty of degrees that don't really have a lot of that in it.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. Digital literacy, it feels now more than ever, it should be much more compulsory than it actually is. And given that we're hearing so much from even just wider than the sort of traditional digitally facing jobs that we talk about, and wider sectors using digital, it feels that we are not preparing students well enough if we don't give them those digital literacy skills to be able to engage with that in the job market. I mean, you know, I was thinking a little bit about this before the podcast today, but very often, you know, what is actually inhibiting students from getting that digital literacy isn't just that they're not getting it as part of a quote unquote formal education program, but often, you know, we often miss out the fact that there is sort of big digital inclusion implications to this, right? If students don't have the right device access, the right connectivity, the right level of access into the tools that are being created, they're often going to get left behind, particularly those that are more vulnerable. They're often going to get left behind as this digital technology gets utilized more and more in industry, in the job market. And so there's much more to be done. And actually, I agree with you in the sense that there's a part of this that is about traditional learning. But I think from years ago, if I can dig out an old wonky podcast that I did back in the day, it does still go back to this part around, so what are the things that we're equipping students outside of the traditional curriculum and program of learning that they're doing? How are we making them, or equipping them rather, for that more flexible, evolving type nature of, you know, really going into the wider world and thinking about how they evolve as people, how they evolve in their skills and their professional capabilities, and encouraging them to look at, you know, the future like that, rather than I've done X degree, so I go into X sector and I use X skills until retirement. It just doesn't work or look like that anymore. And digital literacy is a key component of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally right, Hilary, about the sort of, you know, inclusion, digital inclusion issues. You know, and I think another thing is, you know, there are just, for, you know, for universities and academics to be reckoning with, is there are just a lot of students who are very skeptical about the use of AI. And, you know, there was a really interesting article in Slate this week in looking at over in the USA about students who are sort of resistant and who are being asked to do lots of these kind of, you know, standalone modules or, you know, extra work on how to use AI, and are saying, you know, this is rubbish. I'm being sort of taught to do stuff that is, you know, I'm looking at the outputs, I think it's low quality. This isn't what I want to come to university for. It's, I want to do this, you know, what Hugh was saying about, I want to be learning how to learn. I want to just understand my subject in as much depth as possible, rather than sort of do spurious little bits of, you know, training that are really bad for the environment. That was a theme that came across from lots of the students too. You know, so that, you know, it's tricky for institutions to know to what extent they should be sort of, you know, obliging everybody to kind of jump, to sort of throw themselves headfirst into AI, when many students may, you know, come into this with their eyes quite open and probably in some cases understand it a lot better than those who are being asked to teach them.
Hugh, let me, just before we finish on this, let me just pivot quickly to a related issue, right? Back in, like a couple of months ago, we got the Happy Advanced HE Student Academic Experience Survey, record number of students, full-time students in work, you know, 2/3 now in work. But last week, we got the Happy, oh God, who did they bloody do it with? Last week, we got the Happy Unite Students Applicant Survey, and that said 82% of home students and 94% of international students are expecting to find work during their degree. And, you know, one way to read that is we are about to run out of part-time work for students. That generates a much more urgent crisis, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Although, if we think about the nature of jobs people are doing while they're at university, they're typically service sector jobs. They're typically the ones where you do have human interactions, whether it's cleaning, bar work, coffee work, whatever it might be. It's something like that. That's a different kind of thing to what we're talking about after this one. Will there be a decrease in demand for people to be served coffee in a coffee shop? I'm not convinced that we're quite there yet. The other thing here is that people will be working in different patterns. So the 94%, the 84%, the international home students who are doing this one, they're expected to do some work. Are they expecting a couple of hours a week? Are they expecting 40 hours a week? There's a huge variation in this one. And for some people, it's going to be, if I don't have effectively a full-time job here, I can't complete my study. There's going to be some people, it's nice money on the edge, I'll do a few hours a week, it makes a difference. And I think that variation is where we're also running out of part-time jobs for students. I can't see it happening any time yet. I mean, the trend seems to be to increasing number of part-time jobs as employers, supermarkets, pubs, whatever it is, they're looking to have lots of part-time employees because there's flexibility, because you avoid some of the longer-term employment costs of having people who are permanent contracts, that it makes it easier to work like that. So I'm saying this perspective of being 57. So, you know, it's a decent while since I've been doing jobs like that. So I'm not entirely the right person to ask about these things. But I do think there's an element there, which it'll be fine. There will always be stuff that has to be done in university towns, I suspect.
I mean, the thing is, Hillary, you know, I admire Hugh's optimism, right? But everywhere I look, actually, lots of the places where students might have spent money and then students might be working on the other side of that counter to serve them look closed to me in lots of the places I visit, right? You know, there are catering outlets closing, bars closing, cafes closing and so on. And it's partly, you know, the cost of eating out or drinking out or getting a coffee is now really, really expensive. You know, it's much higher than the average rate of inflation. And it looks like it's kind of pricing students out of the spend bit. And then that makes part-time work harder. But let me ask you this question, Hillary, right? So I'm in a university building today and I tailgated in, you know, with the cleaners as usual, because I hadn't got a pass, right? And I asked the four cleaners, are any of you students? They were not. Then I went for a coffee in the university catering outlet. Any of the three people working behind the counter, are you students? They are not. That is a problem, isn't it? Why don't we employ more students on campus?
Well, I mean, that's slightly an existential question that's outside of my capabilities. But what I would say, just to give context, you are there in the middle of July and most students have either gone home or gone to some form of non-university premises for the summer or are working in...
I'm in a university where there's about 50% commuters, Hillary.
Yes, but I guess the point is that, you know, often outside of term time, students will be looking for jobs outside of campus. But the point that you make is still valid in terms of we should be endeavouring to support students in many ways, including the availability of jobs on campus. But I do think that, you know, not to cast an unfair light on institutions, there's probably more that can be done to sort of create much more flexible opportunities for students to work in ways that aren't just about the service industry. And I think students are finding more of that as they continue to engage with what the different possibilities of earning looks like. But, you know, I can't dispute the fact that the cost of living and studying whilst at university really, really has that impact on students in ways that are unavoidable. So the need for these jobs continue to be pertinent. And I guess, you know, it's down to universities how their models will allow for that job availability. But where it is possible for that to happen, it's always positive for students to feel part of and being supported as part of the university through that availability.
Right, brilliant. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Nick Quinn from the University of Glasgow Adam Smith Business School. And this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about why universities still struggle to recognise leadership that doesn't fit the traditional academic mould. Drawing on my experience as an academic, someone who's crossed in and out of academia, I argue that second career academics bring in viable perspectives but are often undervalued by systems that prize conformity over creativity. Universities say they want diversity and impact whilst rewarding sameness. Leadership frameworks often ignore those who lead through listening, care and difference. If we want a thriving modern academy, we need to stop trying to fix people and start asking what might enable them. That means giving ourselves and others permission to lead differently.
Now, next up, student protection. There's a new report from the OIA and Sums Consulting on market exits. What's going on here, Hugh?
It's a fantastically interesting topic if you are of a certain mindset, and I am. So this is a very good topic for me. And you may have noticed, this might come as a shock to some listeners, but the HE sector is in a little bit of financial difficulty. And one of the challenges is that there is a seemingly increasing prospect of providers leaving the market. What do we mean? Shutting shop. Shutting up shop, stopping taking students, stopping teaching students, ceasing to operate. Now, we've got a regime in England, and this is really focusing at the moment on England and the Office of Students and the requirements in there, around student protection plans. The notion is that you've got a policy in place that should you, as a provider, become unable to deliver the program you've done or you cease to function entirely, there's a plan in place to help students continue their studies. Now, what's been found in practice is that this is mostly cobblers, to use a technical term. We've got situations where previous examples of market exit most of which have been in providers who are small, private, and running validated or franchise programs, have exited the market, and it's been very, very messy. And this is a lovely piece of work. I mean, I think the OIA is to be commended for doing it. I think SUMS are absolutely commended for doing this on a pro bono basis to get the learning from these episodes out there. And really what it's shown us is that when institutions collapse or when programs close or departments close, it is way messier than the thinking we've done so far lets it happen. And you find that there's an enormous amount of stress and anxiety, an enormous amount of uncertainty. The interests of students don't tend to come top of the tree, even if people want to make them so, because actually the legal aspects of bankruptcy, of winding up a company, take over, and students don't necessarily have the status you might expect, particularly if you're in a charitable institution rather than a for-profit institution, which might be set up as a limited company. So there's a bunch of lessons here which are shared with the sector, some really interesting recommendations of practice. I looked at them and I thought, well, there is something different going on here. You've got market exit from a validated or franchise provider. In principle, the university which awards the qualification has got a kind of obligation to step in here. And either they have done so or other institutions have taken over the course, and that's been fine. And in the past, when universities have closed, departments have closed programs, there tends to be a process which is let's make it an orderly transition to another university doing it. What's raised by this report is the prospect that it won't be orderly. If we think about a large established provider, and by that I mean one which is established either as a chartered university or as a higher education corporation, so one of the old polytechnics or teacher training colleges or Russell University or all chartered universities, if one of those ceases to trade, we're in unknown territory. Previously, where institutions like this have come into difficulties, think about University College Cardiff, there was a takeover, a merger brokered with University of Wales Institute of Science and Technology. It became Cardiff University. It was a smooth transition with a lot of money pumped in by the state. We're not in that territory, it seems to me, at the moment. We don't have a regulation in England which is meant to be a steward of the sector, and that makes a critical difference to this one. But also, we don't really have a sense of what happens when the corporation which is responsible suddenly ceases to be a corporation. It's in the same, a similar way. I mean, let's move it. And when you've got a bereavement, a person who dies ceases to be a person legally at that moment. They can't do stuff. If you're an executor, you've got an awful lot of admin to deal with, as well as the grief, as well as the terrible things that have happened. It's going to be similar when it comes to a big university closing. The bodies which might do something about it, the trustees of the organization, the management of the organization, they might cease to have a locus in this one. And that creates an awful lot of uncertainty. So the report says there are lots of recommendations. There are lots of good practice identified things to do there. There's a lot of work to be done. And that's one of the things that troubles me here, is whether universities will look at this and go, we can't actually focus on a what if now because we're too busy trying to make sure the what if doesn't happen. And that's actually precisely the lesson here. So we're in a catch 22. We're too busy to do the work that would make it a smooth process if we did go out of business, because we're trying not to go out of business. And I think that's the challenge for the sector.
Hillary, this feels like a real, you know, when you zoom out, this feels like a real scandal to me, because, you know, when there were still cuts on student numbers, and, you know, there was a bit more planning in the sector, and there weren't so many kind of smaller providers, you know, things were kind of slow and steady. And then, you know, the deal, I think, was in the last decade, we'll hyper-marketize it. This will generate innovation, but it does make it a bit riskier. So what we'll do is we'll put student protection plans in so students can be assured they'll always be able to finish their course. And, reading this, it turns out that students are paying much more than they did in the past in a much more chaotic environment, and really are not protected.
It's a difficult one, definitely. I think it's always going to raise alarm bells if it feels like there's not the right infrastructure to protect students in the event of a market exit. And I think it is right to be thinking about this acutely at this time, where we really don't know what support will look like and what that, you know, long-term sustainability model for the sector will look like, particularly for institutions. And perhaps where my point of view comes from in this is that what it does highlight more so than to sort of brand it as a scandal or not, is how ready the sector are in terms of the infrastructure that they need in order to manage what a market exit would look like. Is the data mature enough? Do they have systems that would support transitions to other institutions, transitioning students to make sure that they still get the same level of a duty of care, the same level of quality of education at other institutions in the event their university essentially goes bust? And so, you know, I do think it highlights a big problem that I think the sector aren't ignorant of, but really have more to do in order to, you know, fortify what those protections look like for students, particularly who will feel the pinch point of what a market exit will look like.
Michael, what's your sense of kind of, you know, why this isn't working? I mean, you know, some people would argue, well, you know, actually what you really need here is a sort of, you know, a kind of levy on tuition fees so that there's some money to actually compensate students if this sort of thing happens. And then, you know, a body that can actually do some coordination when all the other bodies are saying it's not their job or they haven't got the resource. I mean, you know, where should this go to kind of make some of these proposals in here work, do you think?
Yeah, well, that is one of the recommendations of the report, I think, isn't it? Or at least an area it thinks should be explored, like a sort of central pot for sort of student protection money. Oh, you know, of course, the issue is, you know, these days you can't talk about a levy given the international fee one that's in there. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that when the system was set up would have, you know, I think if it was in place and had been running for, you know, close to a decade, everyone would be like, yeah, this makes loads of sense. Now, at the moment of, you know, very significant financial strain in lots of institutions, it sounds like it's the kind of thing that would have, you know, you'd have to drag people to it. It would really require, you know, a government with a clear vision for students and the risks around closure. I mean, in terms of your bigger question about, you know, what's at the root, I mean, I do think it's nice to have an idea about, you know, this is a sort of generalized plan, generalized recommendations, how any institution, be it, you know, large, several tens of thousands of students existed for hundreds of years in some form or other university, and also private providers. But I do wonder how much that really, you know, holds up in the harsh light of day. I mean, you know, so lots of the recommendations here are about, you know, warning signs that management and governance and should be monitoring, you know, but for some of these smaller private providers, you know, the worst actors in the system, which, you know, are lots of the warning signs would really be, you know, are you just trying to, you know, rapidly increase your student numbers and make a load of cash? And you go, is that us? Yeah, no, that is us. Okay. You know, I mean, if you introduce a profit motive into the higher education and skills system, then you're going to have bad actors, and the government still doesn't really have a plan to deal with it. And I don't know whether it's something you can do with sort of one size fits all models of either of regulation or of approaches to governance.
I think there's a really interesting thing here, which is about how the sector's financial difficulties are playing out. In the, I mean, Michael's quite right, that you introduced the profit motive, there is the potential for bad actors. But what we're seeing here is that established universities are also actually doing the same thing, because the only way to deal with costs increasing faster than income is to grow. So we've got all of the established universities also chasing cash through growing student numbers. And so everyone actually is on the same hamster wheel here. And in just the same way as you've got the potential of bad actors in the private sector who see it as cash, you know, profit only, and let's take the money, you've got universities who will, for a different reason, see there's a real imperative to bring cash in here. It means that we perhaps turn a blind eye to some practices which aren't as good. And you see this in some of the franchising issues and how franchises are given to colleges which really shouldn't be. In the same way, universities are pushing things in order to keep the cash coming in, because that's how they maintain the high levels of cost that are being faced. And the same problems arise, is that governance begins to be stretched thin, management takes its eyes off the ball, and we end up with the same problem in relation to practice in the sector and whether we are running stably and sustainably, or whether we are keeping scrabbling from year to year. And I think we're increasingly in the scrabbling bit rather than the sustainable bit of how things worked.
You know, I mean, this makes lots of sense, this report, from the point of view of provider collapse or closure, right? But, you know, one of the ways in which you can survive as a provider is to make pretty radical changes to programs. Yeah, you can start to slash optional modules, you can massively increase class sizes as a result, and so on and so on. I have talked to a lot of student leaders this summer already and asked them to describe the course they thought they were enrolling on and what they actually experienced in the year before they became a sabbatical officer. And almost universally this summer so far, they've been saying that huge changes were made that effectively mean they weren't on the course they signed up for. What is, you know, in reality, what is the difference between massive differences to a program that you've signed up for and your institution closing and having to go to a different institution?
Oh, I agree entirely. I think that's a really valid criticism of the student protection plan regime, but also of universities' behavior. And it becomes one of the pressure points we got here. And you can imagine, if you look at how student protection plans were set up by the Office of Students, they anticipated things like curriculum change. You know, we're changing the modules, we're changing that. And they've got expectations that you will consult with students, you'll make sure you teach out the existing modules, whatever it is that has to happen. But when you look at the other side of that, and as you say, increased class sizes, a less settled academic staff teaching it, possibly a different campus, some of those are less regulated by the student protection plan regime. And it does result in a situation where things seem very different to the students. I think the report does highlight, I mean, there's one critical difference. And I think this is something which legally universities would rely on. Morally, I'm not sure whether they should, which is you still got a degree, student, even if it was a different experience than you expected you signed up to. And that's university's defense in this one. Whereas the fact that, yes, but it was a completely different thing I was trying to do, that's going to be difficult and going to be painful. I do think the challenge that the RFS has, when it originally set up its regulatory framework, nothing like this had been done in the UK before. We hadn't anticipated a situation where we need to think about market exit. We'd got a situation where universities were stable, and if they weren't, the state would step in to sort it out. So there was an attempt made with student protection plans and the infrastructure around that one. It's been found wanting in part. And I think this is part of the evolution to say, well, actually, how do we manage this system there? I'm not convinced that the fund to compensate students is the entire answer. I think, yes, there's elements where compensation helps. And I do think there's something which is, we understand it's not been what you wanted. Here is some money back. That does a lot to alleviate a person's sense of frustration, anger, crossness, whatever it might be. But where you've got a bigger problem, the class, you know, the class size are different. I've ended up doing a degree which was much more about subject A than subject B. I didn't really want to do that. That's no compensation is going to change that, because that's actually 2-3 years of life you've spent learning something different than you expected to. So a compensation fund is part of the answer, but I do think part of this is really about how do we get earlier interventions where things are going wrong. One thought that struck me, if you've got universities which are beginning to think we're in difficulty here, there's a lot of effort put into making sure that they don't get presented as not being a going concern in their annual accounts. And I can imagine there's been 2 or 3 providers that's happened to over the last year. You see late accounts, you see questions raised by the auditors about that sort of thing. I wonder whether those providers should also have been putting out feelers at that point to other universities saying, we might be in trouble here. Can we start talking about areas where we overlap to make sure that the provision is protected? And I think that's the challenge on this one. You don't see that early consideration of bad possibilities by the university's leadership, by the university's governors, because they are too busy fighting the fires. And I think that's part of the challenge. So compensation funds, yes, but they're not going to really get there onto that one. And I think as well, the difficulty is if the whole sector, or as near as damn it, the whole sector, is engaged in the kinds of measures necessary to keep the wheels turning, which is increased class sizes, which is change around the staff complement, using more part-time visiting staff, people on shorter academic contracts, those changes changes are happening everywhere. So how can you focus on the ones or twos that are doing it to change it? Because everyone is doing it. Nearest makes a difference.
Hilary, one final question on this. It's quite interesting this, because obviously we're about to go into a real nail biter of a month, right? So, you know, lots of the people I talk to, not just student leaders actually, are saying that, you know, they're really worried about the clearing period, partly because of the kind of poaching issue, but also partly because, you know, the institution has some targets and they're not really sure what on earth they're going to do if those targets can't be hit. Now, you know, if OFS is right and everyone's targets are just a bit too optimistic and there will be some winners and losers by the time we get to September, one of the people I met the other day said, what I don't understand, Jimmy, is why aren't they all required to already have thought about what the contingency plan is if they don't hit their targets in August? And I had no answer for that because that sounded really sensible to me. But it does seem to me that there's quite often not a lot of scenario planning going on at sort of governing body level.
Yeah. So there's something there actually about the how are we encouraging institutions to be more proactive rather than reactive? And I think actually thinking about what Hugh was saying just now, that, you know, that need for more proactive planning before it feels really acute is really necessary now rather than waiting until then and then worrying about what this is going to mean for the broader future of an institution. I mean, from a governing body's perspective, there is a need for a greater onus to have those scenarios planned so that they can set more realistic expectations, particularly for students, where students may not really know what the state of play will look like if, for example, the institution that they've put as number one doesn't have enough students to run that course and may not be able to do that. And so that sort of scenario planning is always going to be really, really important. But just to sort of tack off of a point that Hugh was making, that collaboration point feels even more important there. That if there is much more of an awareness that we might not be able to run a course that, you know, that there are some students that were legitimately applying to our institution to do this course because we've got X reputation or whatever it might be, that willingness to be flexible about working with other institutions in order to fulfill those expectations or to get students still being able to get the content and what they were expecting out of that course is going to be really, really important if we want the experience of what university is supposed to be about to still continue rather than this sort of ongoing cycle of people worrying about disappointment because there isn't a clear plan around the sustainability of the sector and we still don't have those answers yet. And so, yes, scenario planning is going to have to be really important. And I'm keen to see, I saw that the OIA also consulted with the CUC on this as well. I'm keen to see if any developments will come out of that a bit more formally in terms of what governance reviews are going to look at moving forward, particularly as we see what the next few months bring for the set.
And finally, a record number of 18-year-olds have applied to university. And Hilary, you've been looking at the UCAS data. What do we need to know?
Yeah, so actually for the end of the week, this is some particularly positive news for the sector in terms of students still really reflecting that they see value in applying for university. And what really struck me actually was, whilst we've seen that sort of record high in the traditional 18-year-old applicants applying, I really took note of the rise in international undergraduate applicants and rising 2.2% as well, which, you know, given the narrative around, you know, international students, immigration more widely, that there still seems to be that strong UK HE brand running through that's attracting international students to still be applying to UK institutions. Where we might want to note some equally positive news, that continuous rise in applications will, of course, bring lots of excitement to institutions. But on the topic we were just speaking about, it's much more pressure to think about what's going to be done to support the sector, to continue to accommodate students still being really keen to learn in higher education institutions, but they're not being sort of that clear plan moving forward. But overall, it's looking like a really positive picture. There are some slight decreases, but much to be proud of in terms of people still seeing value in HE more broadly.
Hugh, I see friends and colleagues in the high tariff providers are gobbling up market share again. This is, you know, where does that end?
The tears before bedtime, I expect. I think part of it's an interesting part of the narrative, and exactly what I was wanting to turn onto on this one, is that we're seeing the market responding, both students and applicants and institutions, to how things panned out last year. Last year, we saw the higher tariff providers actually doing quite a lot of lowering their tariffs when it came to the actual offers, to dropping down the A-level expectations, taking students they wouldn't previously have taken. Students have noticed, applicants have noticed. And so it makes perfect sense to stick in your application to our higher tariff institution, knowing that you might get there when previously last year you might have thought, it's a bit of a gamble, I won't waste an application place on that one. So whether we see the higher tariff places simply grow their number of students, expand still further, again, looking to bring cash in the door because that helps stay off the wolf, and that exacerbates the tensions we've seen since 2015. Since the cap on numbers was lifted, that creates a real dynamic within the English sector, certainly, which is going to be about increasing pressure, I suspect, on whether it's, I don't know whether it's on the mid providers anymore. We previously talked about being the squeezed middle, about the providers that were, you know, not quite Russell Group Research, but also not quite Big Civics, and how they were being squeezed. I don't know if that's how it plays out anymore, or whether there's a more simple escalator of tariffs, and, you know, you go down, and the ones at the bottom are the ones that feel the squeeze on this one. But it does seem to me that it's this combination of a drive to bring in student numbers to every university and a increasing number of students applying, which is great. I think this is good news. We're now seeing interesting behavior. Now, whether this means that clearing will be more of a feast this year of students trying to get in places, or whether it'll be even smaller this year because more people have got offers, I don't know yet. I do think that the predictions we've seen for the last couple of years of institutions becoming increasingly precarious are going to continue. I think these numbers didn't make me think, oh good, the sector's safe. They made me think, okay, some of the sector's going to be okay. We're going to have problems coming up.
I mean, Michael, final word to you, really. I mean, today I am in a city which, you know, everywhere you look, pretty much the only thing that's had money spent on it in the past 10 years looks like student accommodation. And it is not a high tariff provider. And if the numbers carry on the way they are, you know, it's hard to believe that an institution like the one I'm in today is going to survive. And that will just, you know, that's the last roll of the dice, it feels like, for this city, right? I mean, do we really want just 30 universities in the UK?
I mean, I don't think we're quite at this point where we should be worrying about, you know, many, many cities around the UK entirely losing their higher education provision, their historic universities. I'm skeptical that the government would not step in, you know, cities, you know, outside London or other big cities that have multiple universities. I mean, I think that's a whole other question. But yeah, certainly
the thing is, Michael, right? Like, maybe the government would step in to save the provider, but if students can still, you know, choose to go to other places and there just isn't any demand, there's so much you can do to bail an institution out, right? If all the demand shifts to basically 30 odd towns and cities.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so there's sort of two competing tendencies at the moment. So first, there is the, you know, higher tariff universities essentially making it easier, you know, lowering their tariffs or, you know, just being more generous with offer making and make, you know, essentially saying to many, many A-levels and students or other level three students that, you know, if you apply to us, there's a good chance you'll come in. I mean, they may have sort of required grades, but we'll also often soften those. You know, the flip side of that, though, obviously, is there's a growing number of students who are as much as possible trying to stay local. You know, we saw that in the Unite applicant index last week. You know, one of the big effects of cost of living pressures on students is they're saying they're only really thinking about their local area. You know, not necessarily even that they want to stay at home, but they want to stay in that region. You know, so there's sort of, to an extent, there's a kind of balance of forces. You know, there's sort of, you know, those who can afford to can go to whichever Russell Group University they want. You know, that's a bit of an oversimplification, but it is that trend is there. And on the other hand, there's sort of more need for great local universities catering to students who, you know, are less economically mobile. You know, so those things to an extent balance out, but obviously the downside of that, which I think no one will be happy with, is that it makes for a much more divided sector, you know, where certain kinds of students have all the choice in the world and certain kinds of students really don't.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Hillary, Hugh, Michael, and also other Michael in his day job for making it all happen behind the scenes. I was about to say we'll be back next week, but actually, this is the last podcast. We'll be back in September. Either Mark or me will be here. Until then, have a wonky summer.